everybody, and welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Jisoo Kyi, and thank you for staying with WGN Radio. Hey, it's Friday, and I've got some other good news for you. Adding to Orion's report, this is something you can look forward to for next week. The rising market is set to get another lift next week. The so-called Santa Claus rally is a short boost in stocks that investors have enjoyed for decades, and it's happens during the final 5 days of trading of the year and the first two trading days of the new year, which Wall Street nicknamed the Santa Claus rally. So there you go. You can think about that this weekend, and that should make you happy. All right, but we're going to start the show with some clarity, get some information on the business of Christmas trees, and also give you some safety tips, too. I know you've probably already gotten your tree, and it's probably already up in your living room or wherever you have it in your dining room, and it's probably very beautiful. But right now on the phone, we have Tim O'Connor. He is the executive director of the National Christmas Tree Association. Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
Fantastic. So let's talk about this. There's been a little bit of persistence in the media that there's been a Christmas tree shortage. This is the fourth year in a row. People have been saying that this is still an effect and a result of the 2008 recession and a lot of folks leaving the business. But what do you say about that?
I'd say that the recession certainly had an impact, but there were other factors involved in the fact that we now have a tighter supply of trees, but we certainly have plenty of trees. The idea that there has been a shortage is a complete mischaracterization of the situation. The story really goes back to the late 1990s and early 2000s. There were too darn many trees, and growers were in a supply situation that was overwhelming them. They couldn't sell a tree at a profitable price. There were just too many of them. And the market got used to that. It got used to there were lots of trees available. You could buy trees as a wholesale buyer at any moment when you wanted them. And as the market tightened up and that changed, people started getting crazy about it, saying, oh my gosh, there's no trees, when in fact we haven't run out of Christmas trees in any of these years when the headlines have said there are shortages.
I'm wondering if anybody listening had trouble getting a tree. If you did, be sure to text us at 312-981-7200. Tim, I wanted to know, does this affect a lot of growers in Illinois, or are there not a lot of tree growers in Illinois? And what is the U.S. Department of Agriculture, what does their data say? Has there been a decrease overall?
Well, Christmas tree farming is very similar in a lot of respects to any other type of farming, in that there certainly has been consolidation. There are fewer producers of Christmas trees today than there were in the past. The oversupply situation I discussed a moment ago affected that, as did the recession. But yet, you know, we still have a lot of trees being produced. Illinois is not a big tree-producing state in the scheme of the industry. We have some very good growers in Illinois, but just to put it into perspective, the bigger producing states at the top end of the industry produce 4 million, 4.5 million trees a year. Illinois produces about 84,000 trees a year.
Gotcha. Okay. So, and it takes a while to get the product. I imagine it takes pretty long time to actually get the tree ready for harvest.
Well, and that is a very unique thing about Christmas trees. It's 7 to 10 years from the time you put a seedling in the ground until you have a crop that's ready to sell. But during that 7 to 10 years, every year there's a maintenance cost for managing and caring for those trees. So it is a very long-term business and a very upfront investment that requires an annual continued investment until that tree is ready to sell. And you know that's part of the reason the supply is now tighter, is the industry had to recover from oversupply and planted fewer trees. And we now have about the right amount of trees for the market, is the honest evaluation of the situation, and demand is growing. Well, people really are wanting real Christmas trees.
Well, I am so excited about that fact that people are kind of going back to the real Christmas tree. I only have about a minute left here, but I wanted to ask you definitively, should folks turn the Christmas tree lights off before they go to bed?
It's always a good idea. Hopefully people are using the new LED lights that don't generate heat. But, you know, keeping your tree watered so that it's fresh, having it stay healthy and you know, not drying out.
And how
really
much water
important.
Does it drink?
You know, if you got a fresh cut on the tree when you put it in the stand, it should still be drinking water. It drinks a lot in that first week, but it keeps drinking all the way through the season. So, you know, depending on the size of the tree, half a gallon a day, quart a day.
Very nice. And is it safe to put presents under the tree? That's my final question.
It's always safe to put the presents under the tree, and hopefully there's a lot of them.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully you'll have a lot of presents under your tree, Tim, because you've been a very good boy this year. So thank you so much to the Executive Director of the National Christmas Tree Association for joining us. Thanks, Tim, and happy holidays.
Hey, thank you, and happy holidays to you, too.
In studio right now on the Wintrust to Business Lunch, we have Tom Gimbel. How are you, Tom?
I'm doing great. Good to see you.
So fantastic to have you in studio. Of course, you are the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network. Tell
yes,
me what your company does.
So we are a staffing, recruiting, and culture firm. So at our core, we help companies identify the talent they need to grow across their whole platform. So we help them do that both on a temporary basis and on a search basis.
Well, I love having you in here because somehow you have a magical crystal ball that you look into and you have predictions. And I have a feeling that your percentage on predictions is pretty good.
Are you saying I'm old and I've been doing it for a while?
No, not at all. I'm just saying that I think you're talented at your job. And you have an idea of what the labor market is going to look like in 2020. Of course, all the forecasts for the market and growth has all been positive so far. Yeah. There was all this recession talk, but it sounds like everyone's kind of put that at bay right now. So what's the labor market look
I
like?
I think you're right. There was a lot of talk of, oh, we're in the ninth inning of the economy. And to quote Mark Twain to the economy, the rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated.
Yeah.
So I think, no, I'm very bullish on 2020. The real challenge that I have is the general population. We always talk about Wall Street versus Main Street. Main Street doesn't realize how good the economy is right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're at 3.5% national unemployment. And even if the numbers, if people say, oh, the BLS report's always been skewed. Okay, it's always been skewed. It's still historically low. And when we have that situation, it's a great economy for people to find a job at a company they really enjoy.
Now, what kind of jobs are we talking about? What types of jobs?
Obviously, the standbys of technology and healthcare. Those are going to be hot for the foreseeable future. But right now, you have sales jobs. You have supply chain. You have accounting and finance, marketing. And good old-fashioned administrative, clerical, call center. There isn't a job that companies aren't looking to fill at this moment in time.
Well, that's fantastic news, and that'll keep you busy, too.
It's a good thing for me.
Yeah,
it's definitely
very good news. Now, I am fascinated by workplace trends, and one of the ones that I really find fascinating are, of course, all the different benefits and perks,
sure.
But one of them is unlimited vacation time.
Yeah.
How does this work, and do people really get unlimited time off?
I would tell you it's the greatest marketing ploy of the 21st century when it comes to work. And it's saying you have unlimited vacation time, take it whenever you want it. And it's really resulted in people taking less vacation. So there's been studies saying there's so much pressure that when do you take it and for how long? And what it doesn't show is that depending on the industry and the company, if you're not there and a big project comes in, who gets it?
Ugh.
The next person.
Right.
Right? If you're not going to be back for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a week, whatever it is, but if they know that you're gone every Friday, you have so much vacation time, you're so good at your job, you're efficient, but you're going to miss out on the next opportunity. Between that and flexible work schedules, which I think are great, I think to accommodate people's lives that have never been accommodated to before is a great thing, but that's not what's going on. What's going on is employees taking advantage of the situation and then wanting to have all the perks that go with if you went into work every day, if you didn't have unlimited vacation.
But you're also saying that employees don't take the time off because they want to make sure that the work has to be done and has to be done right,
yeah,
too, right?
I think there's two pieces of it. One is the work still has to be done. Number two, there's only so much time away that people really, truly want. If you like your job, you really don't want to be gone that much. You think about it, as they say, there's nothing we spend more time doing than working.
And, of course, your company actually places people in jobs that they love.
Yeah. what we like to think so. The majority. But I think that the really key part is that people have to give it a good shot. And what's really the change I've seen in this generation versus when I got into the business 20-some-odd years ago.
Oh, no. Is this some millennial talk? Is this some Gen Z?
No, listen, 80% of my company's millennial. I love millennials. But what used to be is you'd go in and you'd just do whatever they told you to do and grunt it out.
Right.
And now people go and they'll go, I'll give it a shot. And if I'm good, then I'll like it. And it's like, if you don't go 100%, you're never giving your... We like things we're good at.
But now, I'm going to play a little devil's advocate with you. Yeah, I mean, please. Isn't it good that you're getting some of that feedback and pushback, and so there's that interchange of ideas?
Yes, absolutely. What you want, though, is you want people who don't give up. You want people who work through the challenges. I don't love this aspect of my... I've heard someone say, I really don't love this aspect of my job. And I said, I got news for you. I'm CEO of the company. There's aspect of my job I don't like.
You still have to get up and go to work.
You got to go. There's going to be parts you don't like.
So we've talked about working from home policies. Overall, do you find that it's more productive for employees to work from home?
I think it really depends
on the employee.
Yeah, if you have a task-oriented job, it can be very productive to work from home. The problem is the synergy that you get working in the same office space as somebody is very hard to duplicate with remote working.
And this is one that I found fascinating that I just recently discovered is pet insurance.
Yeah, it's a big thing.
Yeah, for employees, for many families, pets are just like family, and they're like children.
Well, we have a sister company, actually, that we were in conjunction called LaSalle Benefits, and we do health insurance and employee benefits. And the number one biggest employee-sponsored plan is pet insurance. And everybody wants to, either if they have a dog, they want to bring it to work, whatever the case may be. And I was just talking to a gentleman who works in my office who's got a dog, and he's got a price limit that he'll spend.
Mm-hmm.
Before he says we got to put the dog down.
No, you never put the
dog
down.
That is what he said to me.
Never.
Yes, he did. $4,800. He said that was his price limit.
No. There's no price on that.
This isn't me.
No price on dogs.
This is not me. This is not
me. The most loyal love there is. I love that you can wear both hats and talk about what employers are looking for and what employees actually want from employers. So if you're an employer listening right now, what are employees really looking for?
Training and development.
Okay.
You've got to invest. Every time you hire an employee, you should look and say, would I invest between $5,000 and $10,000 into training this person? Mm-hmm. If the answer is no, don't hire them. Every employee needs training. Executives need training and development. Entry-level staff and everything in between. People need time and investment.
And we've got about a minute left, but a lot of new Illinois employment laws that are going to be taking effect as well, that are going
to
be affecting
business.
You're
trying to scare
business.
Me off. Do these windows open? I think I'm going to jump out.
No. But one everyone's talking about is the legalization of recreational marijuana.
Yeah, that's the challenge. So now marijuana is legal, as is alcohol. And you don't go and test people for alcohol. But there are, because of the federal laws versus the state laws of what you can test people for and for the jobs in which they're doing it. And so there's going to be, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but a certain period of time for people to have not done the drug. And there's going to be a lot of companies that used to test, and they've got to change the rules.
And, of course, you talked about making sure that you're training employees and, of course, mandatory sexual harassment training as well. That's very important.
Every employee needs to go through sexual harassment training. It's about a half hour to 40 minutes. There's companies that do online video training on this. It's not very expensive, but it's important that employees do it.
Well, there you go, Tom Gimbel. See, you made it. Your perfection, sir.
I'm okay.
CEO and founder of LaSalle Network, thank you so much for being in studio with us, and happy holidays to you.
Absolutely, to you as well.
A lot of discussion about the legalization of marijuana in the new year and about equity surrounding the profits of the business. And right now in studio, we're lucky to have Evanston Alderman Robin Ruth Simmons, who's going to discuss how this connects to the Evanston City Council decision at the end of November about the $10 million reparations fund. So thank you so much for being in studio with us, Alderman.
Thank you for having me.
So can you describe how this connects to the decision by the Evanston City Council?
Absolutely. So just really quick, so that we're clear on what happened, is we have like other cities, including Chicago, demonstrated damages to the Black community. In our case, it was local reparation based on redlining and Jim Crow law and how that has impacted the Black community and continues to impact our community today. We, the city council, passed a local reparation. It will start with a $10 million fund. Those funds are going to come from the sales tax revenue from legal cannabis. And we're real excited. We're hopeful for what it will do to restore the community.
So that's definitely the economics behind where the actual funding will come from. Mm-hmm. So where else will the funding come from?
So at this point, the fund starts with the first 100% of the sales tax revenue. The fund is open to all contributions. And in fact, we've had at least one from a local organization. We're hoping that this be an example that other institutions and businesses, large family foundations might follow us in contributing to this reparation fund. So the first $10 million is going to come from the sales tax from the legal cannabis.
Of course, this is a historic decision for all of America. How does it make you feel to have it in your ward?
Well, it's actually in our city.
Yes.
And I'm so proud to be in this time in history where I can really just connect the dots. It has been the hard work of so many before us that have carried the conversation of reparations and have championed this opportunity. So very proud, so proud of my city. We are committed to equity and inclusion and diversity, and our diversity has been declining. Our Black community has declined to 16% from a higher in the mid-20s. And that exodus has been because of lack of living wage jobs, business opportunity, affordable housing. And it was my thought that we might do something as radical as the Jim Crow law, the redlining that still impacts us today, to bring some repair to our community.
Now, of course, you wanted to emphasize that the reason why this made sense to be seeded by the cannabis sales in the new year is that a study found that 71% of the marijuana arrests had been in the African American communities. So yes, that is a direct correlation for why this was suggested.
Direct correlation that there had been a discrimination in policing, and that policing and those arrests have damaged and devastated the Black community. We all know what barriers are before residents that have a felony conviction. It's kept our community from employment and housing and even student loan access. And it has further disenfranchised us on top of what we've dealt with from the redlining. So right now, if you look at our most concentrated map of poverty, our lowest life expectancy by less than 13 years in the average white resident, it's a complete overlay to our redlining map. So here's an opportunity to bring repair with a new legal industry that is projected to be multi-billion dollar and have a lot of revenue. So I thought that as the Illinois legislation gave a nudge to social equity in the dispensaries, which is absolutely accurate, that we should carry that same commitment into the sales tax revenue as well.
Since the fund is going to be seeded by the 3% tax on cannabis, were you pro or against the delay that the Black Caucus was fighting for recently?
Well, you know, in Evanston, we have a lot of our own concerns.
Yes.
And so I try to stay in my lane.
Okay.
I do appreciate why they would do that, because I understand that there has not been equal participation in the initial rollout of the licenses. But it's a tough call because that revenue can come in and stimulate the community. But I do appreciate that you need to be very careful about cementing opportunities for Black residents and Black business owners to be in the retail space as well.
So let's go back to the economics of this. Have you thought out how to actually distribute money from the funds once the money collects?
Absolutely. So we had a pretty extensive public process during the summer. We had hundreds of residents weigh in on what they thought might be appropriate for repair. And much of that lied in the business community space. And we had at one point a very vibrant Black business community. We had our own pharmacists and our own hospital, our own social clubs, our own Y. And those opportunities were taken away from us because of disinvestment in the neighborhood for back to redlining. And so we are moving forward initially focused on home ownership as a path to building wealth. No matter Black or white, home ownership is the most likely path to wealth generation. But we will continue in looking at initiatives to strengthen the business community and invest directly into Black businesses and the Black business community infrastructure as well. So we have a Black corridor in the west end of the Fifth Ward, which is predominantly Black, that I would like to see us invest in the infrastructure there, but more specifically, a direct benefit to the businesses that are owned by Black residents.
And also money set aside, I'm sure, for fair lending practices, mortgages, also to help close that educational achievement gap as well. So it's going to be funding programs.
It's going to be funding. Well, let me say this. My hope is that we be an example to the community, specifically the banks and the educational community, that they layer on a different support for the Black community in terms of education and program. My hope is that we use this $10 million to be a direct benefit to the residents.
Well, the economics and budget of all of this is definitely going to be something that is going to lead the way for the rest of America. So we appreciate you so much for being in studio with us, Alderman Robin Ruth Simmons of Evanston. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And thank you for all your good work. Should recipients of student aid be disclosed? This is the question posed by the latest article by senior reporter Lynn Merrick of Crane Chicago. Of course, Lynn knows everything about financial services, the markets, and higher education as well. Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us. Explain this to me. There's a media entrepreneur who filed a request, an FOIA request, and he wants to be able to see the names and home addresses of students who receive state aid.
Yes. This is an entrepreneur that some people may be familiar with. His name is Brian Timponi. He's started a few different digital media companies in Chicago, but he's also been associated with conservative causes for quite some time, linked to some kind of right-leaning newspapers that are published in the city and the suburbs. So Brian, in 2016, petitioned through a Freedom of Information Act a request to the state's agency that distributes the student financial aid. He made this request to have the names and the addresses of these students, and the state rejected his request, so he sued to try and receive that information.
And this all comes from a program called the MAP Grant, or MAP. It's the Monetary Award Program. So what is his issue with this this program?
Yeah, that's the state program that makes money available to students who are lower income so they can go to college. And what Brian, I interviewed Brian regarding this issue, and what he says is that he thinks this information should be public and disclosed because it's taxpayer funds that are going to provide money for these students' financial aid. And basically, he says, with a state that has had some history of corruption, and those are his words, which, of course, we can point to a number of things that I'm sure he would cite. But he said, with a state like that, it's really incumbent upon the state to make that information public so we can make sure there's no fraud happening and that legislators aren't doling out favors to different people and making sure that their friends and family family get aid versus other people. Now, of course, the state agency that administers this aid, the Illinois Student Aid Commission, says there's absolutely no evidence and never could be any abuse that results in that kind of fraud. They point to very specific objective criteria that's listed on their website and elsewhere that shows that there's no room, essentially, for this kind of favoritism to creep into the process. Of course, Brian says, well, we don't know unless we see these names. Now, when I asked Brian, can you point to an example where you think there might have been something inappropriate happening in terms of aid that was distributed, he didn't point to any particular examples. So it is a situation where he says, as a concerned citizen, and he notes that he has 5 kids that are pre-college.
Yes, I do see that he's a yes. suburban River Forest resident with 5 Correct. Children between the ages of 6 and 14, and mm-hmm. he is saying that he has a personal interest in Correct. The topic. Mm-hmm. Some other information about him. He is actually the founder of a residential real estate site, Block Shopper, an online publisher, Locality Labs. And the thing that I find very interesting about this article is, in some degree, Crane Chicago Business is responsible for this because he said he was inspired to file the lawsuit upon reading a student's op-ed in Crane Chicago Business protesting the suspension of MAP grants during a 2-year budget impasse under former Republican Governor Bruce Rauner.
Yeah, I'm sure that many people will remember that during the 2-year budget impasse, many of these students had their aid cut off while they were at school. So it made it very difficult for some of these students to continue with their education. And this gentleman that was featured in Cranes, the student, was actually a high school student, and he had led a protest at his high school, basically saying, how can me and my friends plan for high school when the state government isn't making clear whether there's going to be student aid available for us or not? So we featured that student and had him write kind of an op-ed for the publication. And yeah, Brian well, says that kind of caught his attention.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate your reporting on this. This is senior reporter Lynn Merrick. And definitely we will be, I know that you'll be keeping up on this story and we'll be able to read all about it on Crane Chicago Business. So thank you so much, Lynn.
Thanks.
Happy holidays to you.
You too.
Okay, so looking at some headlines on Crane Chicago Business, since we just talked to Lynn, I found this article very interesting. Which companies deserve a lump of coal? It's that time of year when notably nice or naughty players in Chicago business get the recognition they deserve. So I think this is a very good article. You can find it on chicagobusiness.com on Crane Chicago Business. So let's look at the list right now on the naughty list. Not very surprising. Boeing, easily the biggest local business story of the year. 2 crashes of the Boeing 737 MAX jets that claimed 346 lives exposed a litany of failures at the aerospace manufacturer. Of course, the fascinating part of this story was that they kept producing and manufacturing these planes, even though they were grounded, which was really shocking and surprising as well. Also, let's see who else is on the naughty list. We've got Walgreens, based on, this is a list put together by Joe Cahill, who we've had on the show before. When there's a Walgreens efforts to portray its drugstores as health centers, while peddling cigarettes. Of course, this is, Joe Cahill's, article here. The Deerfield chain took shamelessness to new heights this year, announcing a program under which sales clerks will help cancer patients find products that help ease symptoms of the deadly disease caused by other products for sale at Walgreens. So that's another example of a business that is on the naughty list. So that's enough bad news. Let's look at the nice list. On the nice list is United Airlines. Joe says, kudos to Chicago's hometown airline for laying out a smooth CEO transition plan. Oscar Munoz will hand the reins in May to top Lieutenant Scott Kirby, United's president. Kirby has been seen as a likely successor since joining United 3 years ago. Also getting noted on the nice list is Kraft Heinz. The Chicago-based food company took painful medicine when it wrote off $15 billion in value from flagship brands Kraft and Oscar Mayer, but it was a necessary first step away from the ruinous strategy imposed by controlling shareholder 3G Capital. Also on the nice list is McDonald's. And if you want to read why McDonald's is on the nice list, be sure to go check out Joe Cahill's article on Crane Chicago Business. But right now, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.